Hello, it's Monday the 14th of June and welcome to a new week here on Korea 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-ho. President Moon is now in Vienna for a state visit to Austria after wrapping up his stay in the UK as a guest at the G7 summit. We'll have more on his diplomatic schedule in our news briefing, and we'll comb over the results from the G7 summit, which ended with a joint communique taking aim at China. Meanwhile, Moon's time in the UK concluded without an anticipated meeting with Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga. Seoul is saying Tokyo pulled out unilaterally. We'll take a closer look at what this could mean for bilateral ties later. And then for Monday's sports roundup, we'll have our post-game analysis of South Korea's win over Lebanon in the Football World Cup qualifiers on Sunday. Let's begin Korea 24.
Exzellenz, Oberleutnant Schmidt, Mede, eine Ehrenformation der Garde zu eurem Empfang.
You're listening to sounds of Austria's Honor Guard ceremony welcoming President Moon Jae-in, who is in the East Alpine European country today as part of a three-day state visit. The diplomacy continues following his engagements at the G7 summit from Friday through Sunday to wrap up the weekend's events at the G7 in what has been President Moon's first European tour of the year. We're joined in the studio now by KBS World Radio news editor Eunice Kim. Hello, Eunice.
Hello.
So let's take a look back at the G7 summit first. There was plenty of summitry and declarations were issued among the group of seven nations, as well as those including the guest countries of South Korea, India, Australia and South Africa. Mm-hmm. One of the headlines coming out of this summit is in the nation's commitment to boost COVID-19 vaccine supply to less developed countries.
Indeed, the world's wealthiest democracies pledging to provide over 1 billion doses of the COVID-19 vaccine to poorer nations, with half of that set to come from the U.S. and South Korea has said it will also take part. Now, following this year's G7 summit in Cornwall, U.K., on Sunday, U.K. Prime Minister Boris Johnson announced what he called, quote-unquote, another big step towards vaccinating the world, as countries pledge to make their donations either directly or through the UN-backed COVAX facility. President Moon Jae-in unveiling Seoul's plan to offer $200 million in aid through next year for the COVAX Advanced Market Commitment, also known as the AMC.
Now, wrapping up the weekend event, the G7 leaders adopted a joint communique addressing a wide range of global issues, including North Korea.
Right. The G7 welcomed the U.S.'s renewed commitment to diplomatically engage with North Korea, as they also called for the reclusive state's complete denuclearization and for it to, quote-unquote, respect human rights for all. In the joint communique that was adopted at the end of the three-day G7 summit, the nations called for the complete denuclearization of the peninsula and demanded the quote-unquote verifiable and irreversible abandonment of Pyongyang's weapons of mass destruction and ballistic missile programs in accordance with all UN Security Council resolutions. They also called on North Korea to engage and resume dialogue with the international community while demanding that Pyongyang respect human rights for all and resolve the issue of abductions immediately. Meanwhile, on the side lines of the multilateral gathering, President Moon Jae-in also held talks with various leaders, including those from the UK, France, Germany and Austria, as well as the EU.
Now, one face-to-face meeting that did not materialize is with the Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga, despite efforts on the ground level to get one going, it seems.
Yeah, that's right. According to a South Korean foreign ministry official on Monday, Seoul and Tokyo had tentatively agreed to hold pull-aside talks involving President Moon Jae-in and Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga, but that Tokyo had pulled out of that meeting, citing Seoul's upcoming annual military exercises near its easternmost islets of Tokto in the East Sea. We'll get to the Japanese response in a little bit, but that official saying President Moon's bilateral talks with leaders of participating countries at the G7 summit was a significant diplomatic outcome, but did express regret that such talks did not materialize with Japan, a neighboring nation. And we are learning on this Monday that Japanese media are reporting that Suga, it did not view it as appropriate to meet with President Moon when South Korea was not keeping promises made between their nations. Japan, of course, has maintained that wartime historical issues such as those related to comfort women and the so-called comfort women and forced laborers were dealt with in a 1965 bilateral treaty. We're also hearing from the Japanese chief cabinet secretary who rejected that notion that it had rejected the meeting due to the upcoming annual military exercises near Dokdo.
Can you explain to us this military exercise that the Japanese side had reportedly cited?
Sure. They are set to begin on Tuesday, and they are South Korea's first defensive exercise in the waters near the easternmost Dokdo Islets, which, of course, are claimed by Japan as well. And according to a military official here, the drills will not be public, and it will involve the Navy, Coast Guard, and Air Force for the drill. And it is the training exercise in the second half of last year was scaled down due to weather and COVID-19 pandemic considerations. And this year's exercises will be conducted on a scale similar to past years, albeit with some restrictions. And the official said the biannual exercise is aimed at countering threats against South Korean territory and the people's assets.
Yes, we'll be looking closer at the situation between South Korea and Japan in a bit more detail for our in-depth analysis segment coming up after this news briefing, as well as the G7 summit outcomes as well. Let's turn to other headlines now. Let's look at the South Korea's COVID-19 situation. The country kicked off another three-week extension of existing social distancing guidelines with an eased daily toll of COVID-19 cases. Can you update us on the latest?
Yeah, so of course it is on the weekend effect of less testing, but South Korea's new daily caseload for the 24-hour period of Sunday did dip into the 300s for the first time since late March, though just barely at 399. The KDCA said of the 360 domestic transmissions, 68% came from the greater metro region, with 120 out of Seoul proper. Authorities are keeping their defenses up, though, as the virus reproduction rate has surpassed one once more amid the looming summer holiday season starting up next month.
And on that note, July is when the government is expected to introduce a revamped social distancing guideline. It's already started easing restrictions, though, starting with outdoor stadiums where sporting events and concerts take place.
That's right. Effective today, outdoor sports stadiums will be able to hold more people per ratio of its overall capacity. Specifically in Seoul and other regions under level 2 social distancing, up to 30% of outdoor sports stadium seats can now be filled, which is triple the previously allowed capacity of 10%. And for those in level 1.5 regions, allowable capacity will be lifted from 30 to 50%, with quarantine rules, of course, still holding, including wearing masks at all times and zero food consumption. So for our K-pop lover listeners, what does this mean? Up to now, concerts had a maximum cap of 99 people or less, but now that maximum limit has been raised to 4,000 spectators, albeit, again, with restrictions such as no yelling or singing along.
On to domestic politics next. The new young head of the country's top conservative party, the People Power Party's Lee Jun-seok, took his first outdoor excursions as party leader today, and he chose destinations outside of Seoul.
Right. So, of course, these firsts are closely watched, and perhaps in continued messaging that he would be a different kind of leader, Lee Jun-seok headed to the Daejeon National Cemetery on this Monday instead of the traditional route of the Seoul National Cemetery. There he mourned the lives lost in the Cheonan naval ship sinking of 2010 when 46 sailors were lost. He sympathized with the bereaved families before moving on to the southwestern city of Gwangju, where he promised Gwangju citizens would not see the same heartbreak they had endured during the bloody crackdown of the 1980 democratic uprising. The 36-year-old People Power Party chief also promised he would soon discuss matters of jobs, regional development, and the future generation of the Jeolla provinces. He's also said to have positively responded to a proposal from his ruling Democratic Party counterpart, Chairman Song Yong-gil's proposal to form a bipartisan consultation body that includes the government to build a constructive party relations centered on action over finger pointing.
We'll leave it there for our news briefing. Thank you for those updates.
You bet.
Leaders of the Group of Seven Nations wrapped up 3 days of talks held in the UK on Sunday. They delivered a joint communique at the end, pledging to help vaccinate poorer countries against COVID-19, as well as promising to do more to combat climate change. But what caught the eye was the G7 nations' unified and strong position on China. The leaders agreed to work together to challenge China's non-market economic practices and called on China to respect human rights in Xinjiang and Hong Kong. Of note for South Korea, which was invited as a guest to the summit, the leaders also called for the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula and for North Korea to abandon its weapons of mass destruction. To delve deeper into the outcomes of this year's G7 summit and more, we have joining us on the line now Professor Scott Lucas from the University of Birmingham, who is an expert on US and British foreign policy. Welcome to the show, Professor.
Thank you for having me here.
So what did you make of this year's G7 summit and that joint communique that was adopted? A wide range of issues were addressed.
Well, I think it depends on whether you consider the glass half full or half empty. By half full, I mean at least we had adults in the room at this summit. In particular, of course, we had Joe Biden rather than Donald Trump leading the American delegation. So there was a hope that you would actually discuss issues rather than as in G7 summits over the previous few years. No agreement whatsoever on a communique and the temper tantrums that were largely those of the American president. Now, it is true that there were a lot of sweeping declarations at the G7 as a result. The declaration by the United States of a plan for global infrastructure, Build Back Better for the World, the headline announcement about coronavirus vaccines, actually 870 million, not 1 billion vaccines, to be given to other countries, and the idea that $100 billion would be given to other countries to link development with initiatives against climate change. But in fact, some of those declarations really aren't that well, there's a long way to go. For example, on the vaccines, $870 million by June 2022, fine. But the World Health Organization says you need $11 billion to bring the world up to 70% vaccinated, its target to try to get herd immunity. The $100 billion for linking infrastructure and climate initiatives was a pledge made in 2009 at the Copenhagen summit. So they were just restating that. And the question is, how much of this money is new money? Apparently only about $20 billion. So, you know, there's progress which is there, but it is small progress. And we now need to see whether there is sustained collective action in the next weeks and months to come. And importantly, as you headlined, whether this action will be sidelined by the rhetoric of us versus China.
Well, let's get to that now. The biggest headline perhaps was the leaders singling out China. They called for a transparent investigation into the origins of the coronavirus pandemic. And then they also urged China to respect human rights and fundamental freedoms in Hong Kong and Xinjiang. The leaders also agreed to work together to challenge China's what they call non-market economic practices. What are your thoughts on the G7 leaders' position over China like this?
Well, I think that headline in some of the press, especially the U.S. press today, is a little bit too sweeping on what actually happened. The United States, through the White House, let it be known that they were going to talk about strategic competition versus China. And the communique doesn't go that far. As you note, it cites a specific economic concern, which is non-market practices. But that's been a concern with the Chinese for a number of years. That's different from saying that you're going to take on the Belt and Road Initiative and confront it. In terms of singling out Xinjiang and Hong Kong, I welcome that as human rights issues. But that is different from what would have been a more sweeping declaration against China in terms of oppression, in terms of systematically being a violator of human rights, both inside a country and abroad, something that was more the framing for Russia. And the reason for that is while the United States, the Biden administration, is promoting this idea of democracies versus autocracies, some G7 members, especially the Germans, don't want to go so far for two reasons. First of all, you need China on certain issues, for example, to fight climate change. And secondly, Germany does not want to see this as a repetition of the trade wars and the economic showdown that marked the Trump administration's approach since 2017.
Right. You mentioned that we need China on some issues, and perhaps one of them is on the Korean Peninsula as well. The G7 nations called for the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula in that joint communique as well, while welcoming the commitment of the US to engage with North Korea. When it comes to the North Korean nuclear issue, it's been long understood that without China's cooperation, it would be difficult to address. Do you think China would become less cooperative when it comes to issues like North Korea or, as you mentioned, climate change as well, considering what the G7 nations have said during the summit?
Well, I think there's no doubt, if you look at the past few years, that indeed the Trump administration's approach over trade wars, over an economic showdown, did hinder working with China on issues like North Korea. You know, Donald Trump's photo opportunities with Kim Jong-un did not lead to any type of advance on the substantive issues. Now, in 2021, I think the question is, can both sides get back to the rules of the game that they're talking about? I think if the G7 and other countries state specific concerns with China, for example, over the allegation of currency manipulation, over the questions of tariffs and quotas, over the question of, let's say, what would consider be unfair or questionable practices in terms of working with other countries, say in Africa and Latin America, to try to advance your interests versus those of other countries, then I think the Chinese they'll negotiate. I mean, the Chinese do not want a confrontation any more than I think many countries do. But I think if you stoke up the rhetoric that you're talking about a repetition, and I'm seeing this in U.S. newspapers, a repetition of the Cold War, the Chinese will hit back as they have over the last day or two. Remember, there's one thing. It's one thing to say something in public. What is very important is what is being said in private right now between not only the Chinese and the Americans, but the Europeans and other Asian countries like South Korea to say, look, are we going to basically have our fist raised to each other? Or are we going to try to work out a solution to this, which is mutually beneficial or at least means we have coexistence?
So you're saying your concern is that we're going for the U.S. seems to be going for the former rather than the latter.
Yeah, that's my concern with the rhetoric. I mean, and again, let's be clear. This is not to say, as some people and what you might call the left do, which is, oh, China is a victim of, you know, the imperialist or a U.S.-led coalition. If you take a specific issue such as Xinjiang province and the Uyghur Muslims, China should be held accountable for that. That is a gross violation of human rights, to say the least. On Hong Kong, it should be held accountable in terms of the crackdown on people's freedoms there. And then going beyond that, with the Belt and Road Initiative, you know, if the Belt and Road Initiative does involve, in fact, a violation of international economic standards, then you call it out. But that's far different from saying, in terms of strategic competitor, look, this is a country that we will never trust, or at least a country that we will never work with, a country that we will always confront, a country that we will always approach with a fairly aggressive position. You know, if you look at the position of a South Korea, including the president, it's a much more nuanced position, which is, look, you know, let's talk about these issues. Let's do them not only in terms of bilateral but multilateral approaches, and let's see if we can get a resolution which is more of what you might call a win-win rather than what is a lose-lose if you wind out going down the prospect of economic trade wars and, you know, military posturing, for example, in the South China Sea.
Right. It's often been noted that South Korea has a difficult role in striking a balance between China, its biggest trade partner, and the U.S., its closest ally. South Korea, in fact, seemed to distance itself from the G7 leaders' joint communique, saying that the statement they signed, the Open Society Statement, was not targeted at a specific country. South Korea was only a guest to the summit and therefore wasn't part of the leaders' joint communique. The Open Society Statement called on shared belief in open societies, democratic values, and multilateralism. While some have said this was targeted at China, that China wasn't named specifically in that statement. Ahead of the G7 summit as well, there was a pointed statement made by the Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi to the South Korean Foreign Minister Chung Hee-yong in a phone conversation reported by the Chinese Foreign Ministry, saying that South Korea and China should not allow their relations to be derailed by Washington's strategy in the Indo-Pacific region. What do you make of South Korea's position there?
I think you summarized it well when you talked about the notion of trying to balance. I mean, the idea of like an unconditional U.S.-South Korean alliance, indeed possibly with other Asian countries, you know, against China, that's not something that Seoul wants. Seoul wants the idea of an approach in a 21st century global environment, which is beyond this type of us versus them politics. You know, if there is, you know, economic and military confrontation, no one is immune from the waves that follow. You know, no one gets away, as it were, without some type of damage or disruption. And we have seen in South Korea's own history since World War II has been one where it has had to balance between different blocs as it tried to move forward. Now, the question is going to be, how much attention are the Americans going to pay attention to this? Because you'll note, what was very interesting is South Korea went to the G7 summit, and you cited that position very well, which is, look, we believe in global values, we believe in a global approach, we don't believe in targeting Beijing. You'll note, however, also, that the other members of the Quad, Japan, Australia, and India, who are in a military and economic alliance with the United States, they were invited to the G7 because Washington wanted them there as part of the idea of we're lined up against China. Now, which is the position that prevails here? Is it the South Korean position, which is stop targeting Beijing, or is it more the position that you'll see the U.S. pushing for Japan and India, which is, no, we basically make strategic competition our number one rationale for our action?
And finally, as you said, South Korea wasn't the only country outside of the G7 that was invited. India, Australia, and South Africa were invited to this year's meeting as guests. What significance do you think there is in that decision, and do you think the G7 could be expanded to become something like a G11?
I think South Africa was a particular case, which was you just wanted a country from the African continent, you know, a continent which has less than 2% of its people have been vaccinated, which has longstanding economic issues, which is at the forefront of suffering damage from climate change. The other three countries, as I mentioned, India, Japan, Australia, were there as part of this idea, this positioning by the Biden administration of, quote, they frame it as democracies versus autocracies, but more specifically, us versus China. That doesn't necessarily mean that Japan, India, and Australia will follow that American line, without some type of deviation. But they were there very much as part of what I think, and you can sense the fact that while I think the Biden administration has done a lot of good in the United States and could do a lot of good abroad, if this becomes a fixation on China, it will undo a lot of the possibilities, as limited as they are, that were opened up by the summit on health issues, economic issues, and environmental issues.
Well, Professor, we'll leave it there. Thank you for helping us scratch beneath the surface and for your analysis. We've been speaking to Professor Scott Lucas from the University of Birmingham. Thank you once again for your time. When President Moon Jae-in headed off to the UK for the G7 summit last week, there was some anticipation that he might meet with Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga on the sidelines of the meeting. But the two leaders only exchanged a brief greeting and no further talks materialised. Officials from the South Korean Foreign Ministry are now saying that a pull-aside meeting had been agreed on the working level, but Japan cancelled unilaterally, citing its objection to the Korean military defence exercises near Dokdo Islets, a territory Tokyo claims as their own. To discuss Tokyo's decision to cancel and what this means for relations between the two nations, we have joining us on the line now Dr. Bong Young-sik, Research Fellow at the Yonsei Institute for North Korean Studies. Dr. Bong, it's good to have you back on the show again.
Thank you very much.
So what were your expectations ahead of the G7 summit with regards to Korea and Japan's leaders sitting down for talks, and what did you make of the fact that they didn't hold a meeting in the end?
Well, I mean, we have a different media reports coming from Seoul and Tokyo prior to the G7 meeting in the UK. From the Korean media, the expectation was that there is a realistic chance for the leaders of South Korea and Japan to have a sideline meeting during the G7 summit meeting. On the other hand, the Japanese media has been in the stark contrast, very silent about the possibility. And now both governments are kind of engaging in he said, she said kind of a responses to actually what happened or what did not happen. From the Korean side, it was a unilateral cancellation by the Suga government of Japan, but the Suga government responded that that is far from true, and it is very regretful that the South Korean government made a unilateral claim, not based upon actual fact. So the truth must lie somewhere in between these two contrasting remarks. But the bottom line is that it has been the South Korean government that really wanted to have this bilateral meeting to take place, and the Japanese government did not really find any urgent and important reasons to make it happen. So we have to wait and see what will be the next move taken by the Moon Jae-in government of South Korea, whose term is only less than a year left.
Well, where do you think the truth lies then? According to a South Korean foreign ministry official, Tokyo pulled out of the meeting that had been agreed at the working level. Would Japan have pulled out if such an agreement had been in place?
The Japanese government made it really clear that there was no official agreement about the sideline meeting between the two leaders of South Korea and Japan. And there is no correlation, at least confirmed by the Japanese government, that the Japanese side unilaterally canceled the meeting as a protest to the military drill in the water close to the Dokdo Island.
Right, so I guess we perhaps might never know about what exactly happened there. Now, there was a lot of focus on this potential meetup, as relations are so frosty currently due to disputes over colonial era issues and territorial disputes, namely over the Dokdo Islets. A debate continues about whether South Korea should pull out of the Olympics due to the islets being marked as apparent Japanese territory on a map on the Olympics website. Is there anything that can be done at least to thaw tensions currently, or will we have to wait until there are new administrations in place? As you said, President Moon's term ends next May, and Prime Minister Suga, it looks like his future is uncertain to continue as Prime Minister when his first term ends in September.
Well, let's just make a comment about the Japan's position. At least the Japan side is not in a hurry, because even if the Suga administration will not last long and will be replaced by a new leadership, I think there is no substantial change with regards to the official position of the Japanese government as a whole, regardless of who would be the next prime minister or current Prime Minister Suga will extend his terms. It is the same position that the ball is in South Korea's court. The South Korean government has to come up with a very specific and tangible proposal about the agreement made in December 2015 that stipulated that the comfort women issues had been finally and irreversibly settled. And the South Korean government's proposal with regards to the litigations made by the victims of the forced labor during the colonial period. Without those proposals actually made by the South Korean government, whether it will be Moon Jae-in government or its successor, the Japanese government will not budge. So a Suga administration must have made a strategic decision that Japan has nothing to lose by just waiting out the remaining terms of the Moon Jae-in government. And it might not be a bad idea to just try to deal with those key issues with a new administration in place after next March.
There is this, as I mentioned, this issue over that map on the Olympics website. Japan has been unwilling to budge on that as well. And it seems like a somewhat antagonizing move by Tokyo to not listen to South Korea's protests on that. What do you make of Tokyo's position on this issue?
Well, Japan insists upon keeping the map despite protests made in South Korea is in clear transgression of the basic spirit of the Olympic Games to separate politics from, sports. And I have to tell our listeners that the South Korean government made the right move not to make the controversy between South Korea and Japan over the sovereign status of Tokto Islands to affect the Pyeongchang Winter Olympic Games. So right. It is regrettable that the Japanese government did not match the good intended gestures as a host government country of the Olympic Games, as South Korean government did three years ago. Having said that, that adamant attitude of the Japanese government is another illustration that Japan as a whole, as a country, regardless of the political leadership, is in deep distrust towards South Korea when it comes to identifying South Korea as a trustworthy partner for many arenas of potential cooperation, including security cooperation and economic cooperation.
Right, just to explain to our listeners, in 2018 at the Pyeongchang Winter Olympics, South Korea did remove the Tokto Islets from the unified Korean flag, which was used during the opening ceremony. This flag showed the outline of the peninsula and the islets were not shown on there after protests from Japan. And that situation is being compared to the situation currently with the map on the Tokyo Olympics website. Meanwhile, the Biden administration in the U.S. has been very active to engage with South Korea and Japan, especially when it comes to North Korea. Is there anything the U.S. can do to bring its two Asian allies together?
Well, it would be great for the Biden administration to see South Korea and Japan being on the same page in the context of trilateral security cooperation toward not just North Korea armed with nuclear weapons and ICBMs, but also toward China. But it appears that the Biden administration's China policy and the North Korea policy seems to premise upon the assumption that South Korea should not be included as an indispensable partner in this regard, which means that the United States should be prepared to move forward in dealing with China and North Korea without counting on South Korea's full support. This is the kind of conclusion that must have been drawn from the outcomes of the 2+2 meetings between South Korea and the United States and many other bilateral strategic meetings and conversations. So it is up to the Moon Jae-in government of South Korea to make difficult but necessary strategic decisions in terms of, making South Korea count to the Biden administration of the United States for its North Korea policy and China policy to be more successful, and make South Korea count to the Suga administration for the sake of making the Summer Olympic Games a huge success, and, gaining trust from Japan. That South Korea and Japan could move together. I'm not saying that it is all South Korea's fault, but what I'm saying is that Moon Jae-in government has many central agendas that it strongly desires to achieve before the end of its presidency. Then you have to pay the price if you desperately want something. So you have to go back to square one to think how desperately you want to achieve these goals and what kind of sacrifices or what kind of adjustment must be made regardless of political difficulties and historical antagonisms in the context of domestic politics.
We'll have to wrap it up there. Dr. Bong, thank you for your thoughts today.
You're welcome.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index rose 2.81 points, or 0.09% on Monday, to close at 3,252.13. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ also rose, gaining 6.28 points, or 0.63%, to close at 997.41. On the foreign exchange, the local currency weakened 5.9 won against the dollar, ending the session at 1,116.7 won. You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next up, it's a Korea Trending. This is our daily segment where we take a look at some of the other news stories that have been looked up by many here in South Korea today. And joining us on the line now to bring us these stories is Lee Joo-young today. Joo-young, hello.
Hello.
Joo-young, so what do you have for us today?
Our first story is about a young man who was found guilty for intentionally losing weight to avoid military service. We then talk about issues surrounding deleted data being recovered from used smartphones. Our last story is on the major progress of NASA's lunar exploration program, Artemis.
Okay, let's get started on our first story then. And Joo-young, you said a young man was sent to prison for losing weight. Can you tell us more?
Sure. A man in his 20s was found guilty of intentionally losing weight in an effort to avoid serving active duty. According to the legal community today, the Incheon District Court sentenced the 20-year-old to 6 months in prison and 1 year of probation for violating the Military Service Act. He allegedly dropped his weight to below 48 kilograms, qualifying him for a grade 4 in physical fitness, which would then grant him exemption to serve in active duty.
So this was a very much calculated move on his end then?
He reportedly knew beforehand that for men taller than 161 centimeters, like himself, active duty exemptions are granted if his body mass index was less than 17. In the young man's first military service examination, he received a BMI of 16 at 172.5 centimeters. He reportedly lost weight by running 2 kilometers daily and controlling his eating habits for a one-month period in September last year ahead of the exam. Though this BMI qualified him for grade 4, the military initially withheld his physical rating at the time because they deemed that further tests were needed. And before the second examination, which took place 2 months later, he took drastic weight loss measures by starving for 4 days and received grade 4 again, which qualified him to serve as a social service worker instead.
Wow. Okay. So what's going to happen to this young man now? Does his prison sentence exempt him from these serving in the military then?
No. According to military law, he now has to serve an active duty on top of his prison sentence and probation. In issuing his verdict, the court explained that the defendant acknowledged his wrongdoings and that they considered the fact that he had no criminal records in the past.
Yes, the length some people will go to try and avoid military duty, and it was to no avail for this particular young man. Let's move on to the second story that we have today. What do you have for us?
Some data recovery shops in China have been caught restoring private data on secondhand smartphones. These were done through special methods even after the smartphones had been completely reformatted. While the cases have been prevalent in China, experts say that South Korea may not be an exception, as an increasing number of people here are choosing to sell their smartphones as well. Over a million used phones have been sold online in South Korea just in the first quarter of this year alone.
Okay, so the data was recovered even after they had been formatted. How are these shops able to recover this data that's already been erased?
So for just about 140,000 to 340,000 won, these data recovery shops in China can remotely restore data like photos, contacts, phone calls, chat records, and even account passwords for their clients. And what's more, if the previous owner had registered automatic logins to a cloud account, then the new phone owner could gain access to the entire data in the cloud account as well. In Korea, there have been cases previously where sellers were threatened with private photos found recovered from their phones in return for money.
Yes, obviously it'd be terrible if private photos were used for extortion like this. But even for those that do not have such photos, this could mean your private accounts and things like bank details could be accessed as well. So if you want to sell our old phones, but also make sure that our private information is completely protected, what can we do?
Experts advise sellers to format their phones multiple times so that it would become impossible to restore the hard drive. And another way is to delete personal information via companies that specialize in data disposal services.
Sure, I think that most people will probably not want to pay to delete information, but to multiple formats sounds like a good tip and probably the most convenient way for now, but it shows how hard it is to keep data safe as well. Mm-hmm. Anyway, let's turn to our final story now. What do you have for us?
U.S. space agency NASA assembled the first of its Space Launch System, or SLS, rockets, which aims to take mankind back to the moon as part of the U.S.-led manned lunar exploration program called Artemis. The SLS is reported to be NASA's most powerful rocket it has ever built to date. NASA engineers completed assembling the 65-meter core stage projectile squeezed between the two solid rocket boosters at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida on Friday local time. It was the first time that the three projectile components were put together in their launch configuration.
Yes, I remember us talking about the Artemis program a few weeks ago on Korea Trending, as South Korea also recently joined the International Spaceflight Program. So now that the rocket configuration is assembled, when would it take off?
NASA is set to launch the SLS as early as the end of this year. That particular mission, named Artemis 1, will send an uncrewed Orion spacecraft on board the SLS to the moon in an effort to prove the design and safety of the SLS and the Orion spacecraft before NASA sends humans into space. And it's a critical step before the Artemis 2, which will be launched with crew in 2023. Then Artemis 3, which will be the first mission to land astronauts on the surface of the moon since Apollo 17 in 1972, should launch within this decade.
A few years away still, but it's exciting to know that we will see men on the moon again in the not-too-distant future. That's all for today's Korea Trending. Thank you for those stories, Chuyoung, and we'll talk again next time.
Thank you.
We continue on now to get our latest Korean sporting updates. It's time for our Monday Sports Roundup. And joining me on the line now for that is the ever-wonderful sports journalist Yoo Ji-ho from the Yonhap News Agency. Ji-ho, hello.
Hi, thanks for the introduction.
Yes, hope you're doing well, Ji-ho. We begin with a fair bit of football news because there were three matches featuring the Taeguk Warriors over the past week. Two were for the senior national team as they wrapped up their second round Asian qualifiers for the World Cup, and one featuring the under-24 Olympic team. Let's start with the senior squad on Sunday. Mm-hmm. They rallied past Lebanon 2-1, meaning that they closed out the second round World Cup qualifying campaign undefeated. There were initially some concerns in the game as Korea gave up the first goal, but they fought back in the second half. Ji-ho, so a nervy first half, but the team showed some steel in the end.
Yeah, it was really the first adversity for the Korean team in the second round, especially in the final stretch. You know, they defeated Turkmenistan 5-0 and Sri Lanka 5-0 also. And then running into Lebanon, giving up the first goal in just the 12th minute after a defensive zone turnover. And then came some pretty annoying, I would think, you know, time-wasting tactics from Lebanese players in falling down and really not getting up, taking the sweet time on the field. But Korea tied things up in the 50th minute on a header by Song Min-kyu, making his second international start. His header actually went off a Lebanese defender, and Song was not credited with what would have been his first international goal. And then Son Heung-min converted a penalty in the 65th minute, which is awarded when Nam Tae-hee's cross attempt to hit the hand of one of the Lebanese defenders in the box. And after scoring the goal, pretty touching moment for Son Heung-min and also the rest of the football world. He delivered his message to his former Tottenham teammate and Denmark international Christian Eriksen, who had collapsed during a Euro 2020 match against Finland in Copenhagen just hours earlier. Mm. And Son, you know, went straight to the camera, set up behind the goal, and he said, "Christian, stay strong. I love you." That was the message from Son to one of his fallen teammates.
Yes, it was a very touching tribute indeed to Eriksen, who suffered cardiac arrest. An incident, right, as you said, that shook the footballing world. Thankfully, Eriksen is said to be awake now and recovering. It's still unclear why his heart stopped and what it could mean for his career. But for now, it's just great to hear that he is recovering. OK, now back to the Korean national team. They came back from a golden down, as you said, to beat Lebanon. What did you take away from this match and the recent games from the second round overall?
Yeah, you know, for me, in a way, this 2-1 victory was more impressive than the pair of 5-0 drubbings that I talked about over Turkmenistan and Sri Lanka. You know, down 1-0, you know, I just talked about Lebanese players is falling all off the pitch. I guess the lesser Korean team in the past would have let their frustrations boil over and really affect their performances. And, you know, and something like that had happened before in the past against teams like Syria when, you know, players just wouldn't get up from the pitch and Korean players were really frustrated visibly. But in this one, I think they mostly, for the most part, maintained their composure. And Son Heung-min as the captain and as the offensive facilitator really played an instrumental role, rallying the team with his superior offensive skills as both the finisher on the penalty and also the set of man with the corner for the game-tying header. And head coach Paulo Bento said afterward that it's not easy to win every match 5-0, 6-0. And then one goal margin of victory didn't really reflect the true quality of his team's performance. You know, they could have finished better around the net, I think. But, that's been an issue for this national team for years. So, you know, that should really kind of shore up in that regard going into the next round. And also the defense really wasn't challenged. So it's hard to really talk about how well they play because, you know, they barely had to face any challenges in these three matches. But, you know, they're going to have to be more prepared going into the next round as well.
Right, the team did what they had to do, delivering 3 wins out of 3 in their recent stretch and topping their group. So that was good to see, and we did see some encouraging signs in their performances. But as you said, tougher tests lie ahead in the next round. The first of those games are set to take place in September, I believe. So we've got that to look forward to then. Let's turn now to the Olympic team, the under-24 team. Korea beat Ghana 3-1 on Saturday in the first of their 2 tune-up matches. Despite that scoreline, though, the young Korean team had to overcome some difficulties of their own, didn't they, Jiho?
Right. The challenge, really unexpected, came in the form of automatic ejection, direct red card for their fullback, Kim Jin-ya, who was sent off after particularly tough challenge on one of the Ghana players in the first half when Korea was up 1-0 after center back Lee Sang-min's goal. You know, Ghana really pushed hard toward it late in the first half and early in the second half. But Korea actually, you know, held their fort, scored twice after Kim Jin-ya's ejection. So that was pretty impressive. Going a man down, still managed to score twice in a victory. Coach Kim Ak-bum said the red card really threw a wrench into his game plan. But praise these players for responding to this unexpected adversity in the match. And his objective all along has been to make it as demanding and challenging as possible for his players and see if they can rise to the occasion and respond. And, you know, again, going down a man that early in the match probably wasn't in the plans, but it is something that could encounter maybe during the Olympics too. So it just never hurts to be prepared for different scenarios. And we've got the second match coming up at 8 p.m. Tuesday. You know, Coach Kim has said he would use all 28 players in the camp. He used 17 of them on Saturday, and he's going to get the reinforcements. A couple of players from the senior team, Lee Dong-kyung and Won Doo-jae, will actually join the under-24 camp and then for the match. So it looks like they're going to be playing as well.
Right. The players, the 28 players, they'll be looking to impress as only 15 players from this squad will be chosen for the Olympics, as we've said in previous weeks. There are 18 players, of course, allowed for the Olympic squad, but 3 slots can be used as wildcard slots for players older than 24, and Coach Kim is likely to use all 3. It'll be heartbreak for a lot of players, but we'll see how it goes on Tuesday. Staying with the Olympic theme, the national baseball team for the Tokyo Games will be unveiled on Wednesday as well. So there's some excitement there. What are some of the names that should be on the squad then, Jiho?
Yeah, I think former Major League All-Star Choo Shin-soo is having a pretty decent first KBO season here with the SSG Landers. I think he should make the team as one of the outfielders. He could be a force at the top of the lineup thanks to his combination of power and on-base skills. He's got some... He's been showing some surprising speed this year, 13 steals already and 422 on-base percentage for him. Players on the 40-man roster in the major leagues are not eligible, so that rules out the likes of Choi Jin-man and Kim Ha-sung, who were put on the provisional roster in the first place. Ri Hyun-jin and Kim Kwang-hyun, they actually were not put on the provisional squad, so they cannot actually be named to the full final roster anyway. One intriguing name from overseas, from the U.S., is actually a New York Yankees minor league player, Park Hyo-jun, who who is just tearing up AAA pitching right now, batting .338, 5 homers and 15 RBIs in 19 games. He's got a .476 on base, .646 slugging, off to a pretty good start to making his case as perhaps the only U.S.-based player to make the Korean national team. Otherwise, if he doesn't get named, I think it's going to be all KBO players. And Korea will try to defend their Olympic gold medal 13 years apart, way back in 2008 in Beijing.
Yep, so the roster coming out Wednesday. In the meantime, that's all for our Monday Sports Roundup this week. Thank you for those updates, Jihoo, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Okay, thanks for having me.
This is Matt Dalton, goalie for Anyang Hala. You're now listening to Korea 24.
We've come to our closing segment now, Morning Edition Preview, where we take a look at some features and reports that are coming out in tomorrow's newspapers, namely the Korea Times and the Korea Herald. And that means joining us now is our wonderful staff editor, Mark Wilson, Chair, back refreshed from his break. That's my hope anyway. Mark, it's good to see you again.
I hope that too, man. I hope I'm refreshed as well. Good to be here.
Okay, Mark, what do you have for us today?
Well, let me ask you, Jung-ho, do you have any old instruments lying around the house?
Myself, no, I'm not particularly musical. Mm-hmm. I think I might do back home in London.
Okay.
That shows how long ago it is since I picked up any sort of instrument.
Okay. Well, the reason why I asked that is because in the Korea Herald, Kim Hye-yeon writes about the Seoul Metropolitan Government taking in donations of used musical instruments so they can be professionally repaired, disinfected, and redistributed to institutions and to those in need. Mm. Seoul started its instrument donation and sharing campaign today and expected to run through July. Singer-songwriter Henry Lau is appointed to this year's campaign. Since the campaign started in 2019, Seoul has received nearly 1,800 donations and delivered over 1,500 instruments to well over 100 locations, including youth centers and social welfare institutions.
Wow, sounds like a very worthy cause. What kind of instruments is Seoul asking people to donate, exactly?
All kinds. We're talking violins, cellos, even pianos, except for those bought from stationery stores like the recorders. Mm. In the past couple of years, a lot of string instruments were donated, like guitars and violins, but this year the campaign is really asking for all sorts of instruments so children less fortunate can get a chance to play a variety of things. To read more about this awesome campaign and how you too can donate any instruments, pick up tomorrow's Herald.
Right, really you cool. never know when the next musical artist can yeah. come from, as long as they have the opportunity, someone more musical than myself, anyway. Let's move on to our second story. What do you have for us?
Guan Mingyu writes about in the Times when the Korea Times had a chance to sit down with Israeli ambassador to Korea, Akiva Tor, in May. Guan's piece starts off with Tor reflecting and talking about how South Korea is perceived back at home in Israel. He told the Times that when people at home hear he's Israel's ambassador to Korea, they think he has, quote, a pretty cool job. He went on to say that South Korea is seen in Israel as an Asian tiger, which overcame incredible adversity and pulled itself up by its own hands.
Wow, sounds very interesting. Mm. I understand Tor compares and contrasts South Korea and Israel in this interview.
Yeah, that's pretty much the entire piece, actually. Tor talked about how both nations were established in 1948 and how both were terribly poor coming out of devastating wars. And though Israel had fought many wars afterwards, Tor said that, like South Korea, the key to Israel's economic flight upwards was technology. Tor also, of course, addressed how the two tackled the COVID-19 situation, from how the two countries carried out social distancing measures to vaccinations. He also talked about the strong relationship between the two nations pertaining to trade and technology. To read more about Tor's really upfront thoughts, comparisons, and relationships between South Korea and Israel, pick up tomorrow's Times.
Yes, I'm sure many people will be interested to read about this as well, especially considering how successful they've been with their vaccination program, mm-hmm. something that a lot of South Koreans have been looking up to and, I would say, jealous as well. We'll leave it there for Morning Edition Preview. Thank you for those stories, Mark, and we'll see you again next time.
See you then.
And that's where we wrap up our show for today as well. Thanks for staying with us. Join us again tomorrow for more news, views and reviews from Korea. Until then, I've been your host, Kwon Jang-ho, and we hope you have a great day. Goodbye.
KBS World Radio.